This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Charles Gardner. He is an attorney based out of Connecticut and runs the blog Old Urbanist. Charles, it's great having you on the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Thanks.
Charles, you said in your introduction that you're an attorney and you didn't specifically have a background in urban planning. How did you get interested in the topic?
Yeah, it's the type of law I do isn't really, it doesn't involve real estate or urban planning directly. It was more of an interest that preceded that, really, from I guess reading a few books about 10 or 15 years ago that got me into this whole line of thinking, and eventually, many years later, starting to write about it. I think probably the first book, the most influential book, was I know it's cliche, but I'm sure it's the case for many people, was Jane Jacobs' Life and Death of Death and Life of Great American Cities. And from there, just went on to explore various other works. It was something that had always been just architecture in general, an interest of mine, but it took on a life of its own, I guess.
You're based in Connecticut. Did you grow up in New England?
I did. I was born in New York State, but grew up in New England and have lived most of my life here.
Do you have a preference in general for smaller towns or for New York City?
That's a tough one. It's nice to, it's particularly living in a state like Connecticut, you have access to both. There's a few places in the country and the world like New York, and to have a city like that at your doorstep, whether you're living in it or it's a place you go every week. I even though I don't live there and don't go there as frequently as I did, I used to work there 5 days a week until a few years ago. Still need to make sure I go in there a few times a year. I just take a long walk through it. I think it's good for the soul to get that sort of experience every now and then. But as far as preference, as long as there's some walkability to it, some structure to a town, whether it's big or small, you can have basically the same amenities, the same sort of feel.
In one of your most recent articles, Curated Landscape, you made the observation it's been put out in urbanist circles that European towns and cities have a starker divide between the urbanized and undeveloped land. And that's not so much the case in the United States. From my observations, there's a few exceptions where I live in Santa Barbara. It has that to a degree, but parts of Santa Barbara, I'd say a significant part, are fairly suburban. I think the best examples would be college towns in California, like UC Davis, the city of Davis, Santa Cruz, San Luis Obispo, Petaluma, and even Berkeley to some degree. But I've never been to the East Coast. Would you say, is that model common on the East Coast as well?
I'm sorry, the style that you see in California?
Your point that European towns, there's a clear divide between the city and the country, and that's less the case in the United States. But I think you did mention that there's a few exceptions, and those exceptions, they tend to be college towns.
Right, college towns. I think another point which I touched on is in terms of how that sort of urban form is produced relates to infrastructure and land value. Obviously, in California, you have the very valuable coastline, which is hemmed in by mountains, and in the interior, you have very high-value agricultural land for fruits and vegetables that are relatively expensive compared to staple crops. So you see this sort of intense concentration of development in these clearly demarcated lines. New England, by contrast, and this also applies to a lot of the American Southeast and some parts of Florida, where water is more abundant. For example, in New England, it's very, very common. I would say majority of homes are on well water and septic tanks. which requires a certain amount of land, and tends to produce a much more spread out pattern of settlement. In New England, although there are farms left, generally the agricultural land values are pretty low and the development land values are high. So,
are you talking primarily about a suburban sprawl or a rural area where people live on like a 2-acre lot?
Well, a 1-acre, 2-acre zoning is very common in a lot of these towns. Certainly there are older urban areas, very dense urban areas throughout New England that developed during the late 1800s, during the period of industrialization. But new developments at that density, especially since 1920 or 1930, have been fairly rare, and a spread out pattern of development is predominant. Something you could see, driving through it or through aerials of New England, but that's the predominant type of development.
And it's kind of ironic because people generally associate California and the Sun Belt more with suburban sprawl, but California suburbs, they tend to try to cram in. I mean, they're single-family homes, but they try to cram in as many homes into lot sizes as possible. So they are, in a sense, fairly dense, but that doesn't mean that they're walkable.
Not walkable, but I completely agree with you there. I think the typical image or the photo you might see used next to a caption showing suburban sprawl is a picture of a Riverside or Las Vegas or a new subdivision in Phoenix where you really have this very dense clustering of housing. I think Las Vegas, for a city of its size, is one of the on average the densest American cities. Now we're not talking about weighted density like New York, but just overall density, because there's very little of that low density development. Everything seems to be built, whereas the sprawl of Atlanta is maybe a little less visually impressive. Everything is green. There's more of a topography. It makes less of an impression, even though maybe much lower density. So, no, I definitely agree with that.
There's what is more aesthetically pleasing, because a lot of these East Coast suburbs that maybe they have a semi-rural feel to them and they have lots of trees, and they're pleasant places to live compared to your typical inland, like Southern California tract housing development. You're very dependent on a car if you live there. They're not like your traditional pre-car, rail car suburbs.
No, that's exactly right. And once a city reaches a certain size, I think I've written something about this where even a city like Atlanta in the 1970s developed a subway system, developed, we would consider the height of the motoring era, the 60s and 70s. In one of the lowest density cities in the country, did vote to fund MARTA, fund the rapid transit system. So at some point you can't get away from it. The city reaches a size where it's just untenable. But where that point is exactly, I'm not sure. I don't think Las Vegas is there. Obviously, LA has. I've only been there once, but. It's a substantial subway system and is expanding that system, expanding the transit.
Well, Las Vegas has a monorail behind the strip.
Right. I think they have a monorail, although I don't know how much that's used by residents for commuting or from getting one part of the city to the other. My impression was it was more of a tourist thing, and they relied on their bus system. But, in terms of a light rail system or a heavy rail a subway system, something along those lines, is the type of transit I'm referring to. And in those cases, the densities that are built up, even in Las Vegas or Phoenix, are it's difficult to make heavy rail, high speed transit work in the numbers you'd want it to work at in terms of the ridership. It's just because of how the city is spread out.
And one other thing about a lot of these Sunbelt cities, that like Phoenix, they have these massive parking lots around downtown. But then you contrast that with a city. You write about Vancouver, and you call it a zoning straitjacket, or their downtowns are surrounded by single-family homes. I think Portland, Oregon's probably the same situation. And that basically means that the city has a permanent straitjacket around its downtown to prevent expansion. It's ironic that these places that are like Phoenix, that have been traditionally been seen as urban planning disasters, so that provides more opportunities to expand their downtowns.
Oh, you mean that the predominance of vacant lots?
As opposed to, you wrote an article about Vancouver, about how there's a belt of single-family homes around its downtown.
Right. Even in Vancouver, I think there was a sort of an industrial belt that was expanded on a little bit, provided some of the opportunities for growth. But it's true. If you, you know, the Sunbelt cities like Houston and Dallas and Phoenix, that never really developed a intensely built out downtown, sort of have many opportunities for infill development that maybe is somewhat less politically controversial. Everything's going to be politically controversial to some degree when it comes to you know, denser development or new uses, but there may be a little less political friction in seeing some of those changes as compared to Portland or Vancouver, where you know, those sort of opportunities are more limited.
Sam, do you want to comment on some of the towns around where you live?
Yes. The only walkable suburb I could think of is Sierra Madre, which is just east of Pasadena and north of Arcadia. That town is very small, and there are no stoplights at all. It's all stop signs. And it's a very walkable neighborhood. It's kind of like a Midwest town that's very small. It's a nice, like if you want a nice pace of change from the typical Southern Californian town, I think Sierra Madre would be a good place to go. Have you ever been there?
I've never been there. I feel like I want to look it up now. I'll have to pull it up. But you mean sort of a gridded style town? See if I can.
I'm not sure if I've been there. I'm familiar with La Cañada, Flint Ridge. Sam, would you say it's comparable to that?
Kind of, but like La Cañada, Flint Ridge doesn't go as far, you know.
It's interesting. Kind of, there's like this distinction. Is there's a suburbia, and then there's a small towns. Like, what defines a suburbia? Basically, the situation in LA is all the original small towns were just absorbed in by suburban sprawl. But I was recently in the Bay Area, and you do have these small towns, like places in Marin County, and the area is inland from Berkeley. Like, there's a town called Lafayette, which is, it's more like a traditional small town surrounded by a green belt that has a BART access. Do you consider those places in general to be small towns? And do you have a lot of similar comparisons on the East Coast in places like Westchester County?
Yeah. You know, it's difficult to say. A lot of the labels are the labels that are used here can be subjective. I mean, very often when you're talking about these small towns, or whether you call them suburbs or bedroom communities, they go under a variety of names. They're especially if they're linked by transit, they really are part of the broader urbanized area. And usually when you look at you know, how urbanized areas are calculated for purposes of, you know, population density and various other things, these towns are considered part and parcel of the urban area. On the other hand, they're often politically distinct, you know, have their own separate governance, may not be politically tied into the city directly in any way at all. So in that sense, they may function very much like a small town with their own, you know, mayor, first selectman. So it sort of depends on the way you're looking at it. It's a part of the broader economy for sure, but politically it may have its own independence. And there are a whole realm of possibilities in between that, varying degrees of integration. As far as Westchester County in New Jersey, a lot of these, I guess what you could call small towns or commuter towns sprung up along the railroad lines, along the New Haven line, the Harlem line, and various other lines that came out of the city. And prior to that, prior to the railroads getting there, these were generally farmland up until the mid 1800s. A lot of it was really not built up that long ago. And where the railroad stops were built, you generally see these dense little clusters, little town centers that sort of owe their existence to the railroad stop.
Would you say Pasadena in California is an example of a rail car suburb?
I don't really know enough about Pasadena to comment on that. I don't know whether it was built up. It was served by rail transit. I'm just not. I'm not as familiar with the transportation history of LA as I am with some other places.
Sam, how would you just describe Pasadena?
I would definitely describe it as more of a suburb than a small town. But like the difference between Pasadena and Sierra Madre is like the difference between Pasadena and downtown LA. It's that different.
Pasadena does in the downtown area, it feels relatively urban.
Yeah, it does. In Old Town, it does. But if you get out of Old Town, it's pretty chill.
One of the things is there's suburbia, there's urban areas, and then there's wilderness. And I think if you have money, the ideal place people want to live is they want to have access to both an urban downtown and access to wilderness. That's the ideal. People crave that variety, but the problem is there's this sort of narrow amount of land. So that's kind of was the kind of ideal of the original rail car suburb. Then it led to this massive suburban sprawl where vast areas were covered in suburban sprawl and they became less desirable. Would you say the key factor of desirability is having access to both a vibrant downtown and access to open space?
I mean, I think definitely part of the allure of the suburbs in the beginning was, just having access to a little more land, even if it wasn't wilderness, a plot of one's own. I mean, this is a story that's been covered in many books. I'm thinking like Crabgrass Frontier. Kenneth Jackson is one of them. Bourgeois Utopias. Sam Bass Warner's book on streetcar suburbs, sort of that, the economic, social, cultural way these sorts of places developed. If you go back, I think, and look at the way some of the early suburbs were marketed, particularly in the streetcar era in the early day of the car, was that the land values were lower. You could afford to have your own separate dwelling, and if you did have access to a car or access to a train station, you could use that to get to a more wilderness or recreational area, whether that was the beach or the mountains or whatever it might be. I don't know that there was an expectation that wilderness would be right outside your front door, but certainly these new modes of transportation opened up that possibility in a way that hadn't been possible for at least a couple centuries before that. So,
one thing you wrote about is you talked about European versus American art and the concept of rural lifestyle and how America has traditionally focused more on wilderness while European paintings depict cultivating the land. And you talk about how conservation groups like the Sierra Club focus more on wilderness. In Southern California, I mean, there's vast agriculture in the Central Valley, but in the Southern California region, there is a significant amount of wilderness if you go up into the mountains, but agriculture is pretty rare. What are your thoughts on the distinction between the two? And when you say agriculture, I think people have more of a passion for preserving wilderness, but your point is that agriculture is at risk for suburban sprawl.
Yeah, I mean I think the original post that was published on Strong Towns, they used maybe some better paintings. I originally had one of one of Bob Ross's paintings, which I thought, you know, it's sort of popular art, TV show, something that's well known to people, and he always was painting some American West scene, you know, with the pine tree in the corner and a majestic mountain and very little, if any, sign of agriculture or human habitation. Sometimes one little abandoned cabin in the corner. That's in a long tradition of American fine art. You know, the Hudson River School, Hudson Valley School, portraying these majestic, sort of untamed landscapes, sort of sparked the imagination of painters in North America, whereas in European art, and this goes for landscape architecture as well, maybe it's simply an artifact that the land had been settled for so much longer, there is sort of a different value placed politically, culturally, on agricultural traditions. And I think that's reflected in the art as well.
Yeah, that was my observation in England. England doesn't really have the vast wilderness that the United States has. It's primarily mostly agriculture with small pockets of forest.
Right. Well, I mean, just the density of population in England, how long it's been settled, their concerns are, I think that we're putting the Town and Country Planning Act, which was the major planning legislation in the late 1940s, was, you know, about conserving the farmland, which was perceived as having sort of its own separate aesthetic value. You're right, there wasn't the wilderness necessarily to preserve. There weren't, it was heavily cultivated, but that was perceived as having its own independent value, being part of the identity of what England was. Whereas in the United States, there are a few exceptions where the landscape has really been singled out. An agricultural landscape has been singled out. Lexington, Kentucky was one example, I think, with the horse farms there. It was one of the first American cities to adopt an urban growth boundary, an urban services boundary. But by and large, American cities have not had that sort of similar emphasis on protecting agriculture and establishing clear growth boundaries. Excuse me.
With the whole urban growth boundary, I've talked to people from market urbanism, and they make a kind of a free market libertarian case for urbanism. And their argument is that suburban sprawl is a product of government infrastructure because the government subsidizes private developers by building roads, waterways, highways. And I think that's a valid point. But at the same time, if you got rid of all these environmental conservation laws and historic preservation laws in the most desirable areas, I think you would see a wilderness get developed. Places like where there's high real estate value, places like Westchester County and Connecticut, or places like Marin County and Malibu in California.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I know the market urbanism. I've been reading many their work for many years. Stephen Smith's work. I know they have a lot of other guys who are now writing on similar themes. The thing is, you know, as far as development goes, the role of politics as opposed to economics is so important. It's really difficult to put the question in isolation, to say, you know, except for such and such a regulation, or except for such and such a master plan, development would be this way. There are examples in the world, I think, where you have a more or less truly free market urbanism, where government control is minimal, and that's the shanty town, squatter settlements, the favelas of Brazil, where you see these rather extraordinary settlements, which clearly aren't obeying any environmental laws, to build, you know, right up the hillsides. almost 100% lot coverage, this sort of thing. But generally, when you're talking about the United States, the when you're talking about urban design, you're talking about a question of politics. So the question then becomes really what direction you want to push that in and how you're going to do it. The theoretical questions are great, and I've written, God knows, I've written a ton of pieces about against zoning, against Euclidean zoning, but you have to be pragmatic about it too.
Is there an issue with the zoning laws? Is say there's interest in new urbanism to retrofit suburbia, like to turn a strip mall or a Walmart into a walkable mixed use development. Often there's mandatory parking requirements, so that's zoning is a barrier to that.
Yeah, well, this is something that Nathan Lewis has written about. I don't know if you've read any of his articles on his blog. It's not. He's been of a side interest for him. He's mainly writes on monetary policy. He's written a couple of books, like three books now on that. But I know he has a couple of articles on that. Andrew Price also has written on this. On the sense that these sort of oversized suburban development sites for commercial sites, whether they be abandoned malls or strip malls or whatnot, are good sites for redevelopment for a variety of reasons. One, it's just a tremendous amount of land. A lot of it's underused. And secondly, there might be less political obstacles to getting something built there. It's probably under single ownership and there isn't much in the way of neighbors or anything like that necessarily to raise complaints about a new development. So I think that's definitely something that the new urbanists have been looking at too, ways of whether it's just knocking everything down, starting again, or infilling these areas, and in doing so sort of managed to create a walkable downtown out of what were these tremendously car-oriented sites.
One example you gave in your blog is a Whole Foods in D.C. with a rooftop parking. And I've noticed the same trend with some of the urban targets. Like there's one in L.A. which was built out of a former department store that has that. Actually, it's a urban target on the first. This is a Westwood Village, an urban target on the first level. And the second level is a parking and a Ralph's.
Yeah, the obviously, it's going to be far more expensive in general to build structures.
That one wasn't built from scratch. It was built out of an old department store.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know. I mean, here in Stamford, in Connecticut, there's a target that's been built vertically. If the land values can support it. Yeah, it's interesting to see how these big box format stores, which are associated with the outskirts of the city, can actually be accommodated into urban areas itself, which isn't new, obviously. I mean, there were department stores in the heart of cities many, many decades ago. So in some sense, seeing a Target or a Walmart or whatnot return to these urban locations is sort of bringing back what once was. You have it's encouraging to see that trend for me, even as much as some people like to talk down Walmart and some of these other places. You know, if they can be adapted for urban settings, I think all the better.
What have been some of the observations from in Stamford, Connecticut, and some of the most recent changes? Is it more historic? Is there more of a balance between the historic and a new structures going up?
Well, Stamford's an interesting case. I mean, generally, Connecticut cities, in general, just fallen on hard times in the late 20th century. Very industrial. Stamford wasn't even one of the most industrial ones, but its downtown was largely wiped out, with the exception of two or three streets in a major urban renewal project back in the 70s. So there isn't a tremendous amount of the old urban fabric that's left. And then, of course, I-95 was built right through the city with the pluses and minuses that come with that. So the development that's taking place there is generally infill development on empty or underused sites.
What are your thoughts on height restrictions? The best example is the one in Washington, D.C.
Yep. Yeah, there are height restrictions in all zoning laws. I think the ones that stand out for people just because they're the most visible are downtown height restrictions, which most American cities had in the past. Most of them gradually abolished them in the late 1800s through the early 1900s, and most of them were more or less gone by the 1920s.
Yeah, I know L.A. had one because of earthquakes.
Yep.
I think they ended it in the 1960s.
Okay. And even then, it was probably something like 400 or 500 feet, I'm willing to bet, by that point. So that, I think Denver had one early on that was 150 feet, then it was 200 feet, and then eventually, that went by the wayside. So really, among large cities, right, it's an area that covers the entire downtown is Washington, D.C. I also think Madison, Wisconsin has a similarly restrictive one. I mean, this is sort of a controversial issue, and it always seems to be just a flashpoint for discussion. I mean, I've come out in support of them in general, and some of the posts I've written, I know the market urbanism guys, a lot of other people, sort of the Ed Glaser contingent are generally hostile to it. My take on it is just this, is that the zoning regulations that affect the supply of housing in an urban area the size of Washington, D.C., are not the ones that apply to the very center of the city. They're the ones that apply to the other 95% of the city, to the Capitol Hill neighborhood, to Georgetown, to the suburbs far beyond that, out into Virginia, up into Maryland, where the regulations are far more restrictive. I just don't know that the height restrictions in a city like Washington, D.C. are really having any sort of impact on the housing situation in the metro area. So it's not a make-or-break thing for me, but I think there's a little too much emphasis placed on that as opposed to other things that would be less politically controversial, more and more achievable.
One thing you wrote about is a 70s urbanism and these massive urban renewal projects that came up, that went up in that era. I know a new urbanist really despise those projects, but when I was recently in San Francisco, there's one of them called the Embarcadero Center, and I actually disagree. I really like those places. I mean, I can't comment on all of them, but that particular one, I think aesthetically, it's not. I wouldn't describe it as a postmodernist in the sense that it has no regard for the past, because you do see sort of an ancient influence in a lot of them. I know John C. Portman said in an interview that his biggest inspiration was the Champs-Élysées. But from a more practical standpoint, if you go to the Embarcadero Center, you can cross several blocks on these very wide sky bridge. This sky bridge that has gardens and fountains, and I think a lot of them do have practical purposes. What are your thoughts on some of those projects, and why do you think that some urbanists have this visceral disgust to them?
Yeah, the 1960s and 1970s, it's important, I think, deservedly get a pretty bad rap for the urban ideas that came out of that period. But from another perspective, I think what I was getting at with that piece is that that era also saw the beginnings of an urban rebirth and an emphasis on the pedestrian that hadn't been there for many, many decades. A lot of these developments from that area tend to be self-contained, like you, I think you're referencing the notion of the arcology, this encapsulated, entirely self-contained structure where the person doesn't even have to go outside, where they can pass through sky bridges and underground tunnels and whatnot. There's an example of that actually in Washington, D.C. as well, the Crystal City complex, which is from the the 70s, where there was this entire series of underground tunnels where obviously it's entirely pedestrian, where people can essentially take the elevator down from their towers, walk underground to various shops and whatnot, walk directly to the subway. And that project also dates from the 70s. Now, it's come under plenty of criticism, too. I think now they're trying to reactivate the I haven't been there in a while, but they're trying to reactivate the street level with, restaurants up there. But the general sense of trying to accommodate pedestrians into a contemporary high-density development, trying to actually think about how people got around in that way, was something that did come out of the that I think very important that came out of that era. And I don't think you could just write off some of these projects as unrealistic or utopian, as in many cases that infrastructure is still there. I mean, Houston's system of underground tunnels, I guess Minneapolis is well known for its skywalks, things that people still value today. And I think that unfairly get lumped in with this whole general, post-war suburban era. So
I also think a lot of these new urbanists have their focus more in the sort of late 19th century to early 20th century model of urbanism, where everything is on street level. I think a lot of those projects, arcologies, I mean, the famous example is Solari's proposed one in New Mexico, but I think a lot of those mega developments, I mean, you can see make some comparisons to medieval architecture.
The inspiration for some of them, I know, went back to that era, even if it wasn't a literal interpretation. There were some general inspirations from that period. But you have to remember, before the 1970s, there was very little precedent in American urbanism, really going back to the earliest European settlement of North America, but a truly pedestrian-oriented urban environment. I mean, some of the very early cities that were built out, Boston and a few of the other seaport towns, tend to have that that old urbanist, that old world sensibility to them. But since then, really, pedestrians have not been at the center of the central focus of planning. It's been about wide streets, accommodating wheeled commerce, bigger and bigger and better, without necessarily thinking about some of these other quality of life issues that they were beginning to consider by the 60s and 70s, and which had been an increasing focus, I think, ever since the late 1800s.
You also did write about the ancient Middle Eastern souks and the shopping arcades that are common in European cities. And, I mean, that's an example of a shopping mall, the arcades. Well, I think the souks, I can't really comment on them because I haven't seen one. Some of them may be more self-contained, but the arcades in Europe, they're well integrated into the urban fabric. And ironically, I mean, that's sort of, every mall in the 80s was called a Galleria, and that's kind of a reference to, like, the Galleria Emanuele.
Yeah, yeah.
In Milan.
In Milan, yep. Right, and it would be generally out somewhere out in the fringes of the city, surrounded by, 50 acres of parking. In general, whether it's Middle Eastern cities or European cities, North African cities, the whether it be the bazaars or souks or malls, markets are much better integrated into the city in a way that's really not terribly difficult to do. There are a few cases of American cities that, between 1950 and 2000, that did try to bring malls right into the downtown to revive a downtown that seemed to be faltering. But
one example of that, there's Horton Plaza in San Diego, which has declined recently, but it did play a crucial role in revitalizing downtown San Diego, and it does have kind of that influence of like an old medieval city where you go for these narrow walkways.
Yeah, the I mean the typical bazaar. I guess one of the most famous examples is in Istanbul. Really are just narrow, very elaborate, sort of almost a labyrinth of passageways, covered passageways that really, in its dimensions and its appearance, is not completely dissimilar from, you know, an American style mall. It's entirely pedestrian oriented. It's largely enclosed. It's just integrated in a way that most American shopping malls are not. Even when they're plopped down right in the middle of a city, sometimes they stand alone and are not that oriented to the surroundings. You know, they might just present a blank wall to the street, which is the case in a couple of the examples I know. So there's definitely room for improvement, but I just cited those examples to show different ways they could be incorporated into a city.
You wrote about a narrow streets, which are common in European cities. One example you pointed out is Maiden Lane in San Francisco. That's probably one of the best examples in the U.S., but they're more rare.
Yeah, in the United States overall. I think the whole old urbanism concept, I didn't even – it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek – the title of the blog was sort of a tongue-in-cheek thing. And it was just playing off the new urbanism. When I created it at the very beginning, but I think there's a Reddit old urbanist page that
I saw that.
Yeah, Ziff Campbell actually.
You're saying so, kind of the new urbanist. Their focus is very much on the late 19th century model, but old urbanism is. So you're saying it's more tongue in cheek. You're not saying like every project has to be in this rigid standard of like 500 years ago.
Well, yeah, I think when I wrote it, I didn't when I came up with the title, I didn't really hadn't really fully developed those ideas and wasn't even necessarily thinking about very narrow streets. That was something that came along a little bit later when I read some of Nathan Lewis's work, which he had started writing about, I think, as early as 2005 and 2006. My thoughts were kind of going in the same direction. But I think Ziff Campbell, who created this page, created a little about where he put a definition, which is better than I can put it. This is not what I envisioned at the beginning, but this is, I guess, what it's morphed into. He says, I kind of like his definition, so I'll just read it. Old urbanism is the theory of urban development and planning that espouses, amongst other things, narrow streets and mixed-use layouts to foster community, human-scale environments, pedestrian-centric transportation, and healthier and greener lifestyles. So that was not what I meant when I started out with the title, but if that's what it's become, I'm glad, I'm flattered, because it's become something distinguished in some ways, right, obviously, from the new urbanism.
You wrote about this new Harry Potter theme park at Universal Studios Orlando. I was thinking about Disneyland was a good example of that, because Disneyland was built up at the heyday of suburban sprawl in Orange County, out of all places, from the 1950s up to the 1980s. But what's interesting about Disneyland is that it's entirely walkable. There's no cars, and there's also a train and monorail system.
Right. Yeah, it seems kind of paradoxical, right? It's you have this emblem of Americana, the United States, and it's an entirely pedestrian environment. I know I've sort of commented on that, and as well as the Universal Studios exhibits, which. I guess the Harry Potter one has been enormously popular, but essentially it's a recreation of narrow streets of London and various other English medieval towns that were used as settings. Sort of obviously the appeal is the book and the story, but these are what's being presented to people are these urban environments, which, you know, in my opinion, can stand on their own and provide part of the appeal.
And even you touched on Las Vegas as far as their suburbs. I mean, out of all places, Las Vegas is a place that's known to be artificial. But what is ironic is that the main part of the Las Vegas Strip does function as an arcology in a sense, because if you're staying there, you have all your amenities within a walking distance.
Right. Well, the certainly one of the large resorts, right? It'll provide all the essentials, all the day-to-day necessities, as well as obviously abundant luxuries. I mean, to me, this is one of the earlier things I wrote. Another example of that is the cruise ship, which is an entirely contained urban and pedestrian urban environment, very high density, often thousands of people, essentially providing all daily needs as well as far beyond that. I know that very notion of a cruise ship was one of the things that inspired some of these late 20th century urban designers, some of those, the architects and planners that came of age in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I don't know if Soleri was inspired by them, but...
You do talk about the concept of heroic materialism in architecture, and that is kind of about building stuff on a grandiose scale.
Right.
You say that it dates back to the Baroque era in the 18th century. Couldn't you make a case it dates back to the ancient pyramids?
Oh, sure. No, you could. Well, that phrase, the heroic materialist phrase, is not my own. That actually comes, I think, via Nathan Lewis from a television series from the 70s. It was hosted by Kenneth Clark. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a series which essentially covers the span of Western civilization, starting from very ancient times and taking it up to the mid to late 20th century. And heroic materialism was what he termed the industrial and post-industrial era, where the focus was on monumental engineering achievements, where that was seen as the highest accomplishment of civilization.
It's kind of ironic that as you see that in these up-and-coming cities, like cities like Dubai and the Chinese cities. But the thing is, in America, it seems to be people are more obsessed with things like social media and pop culture than they are with building these grand architectural monuments that we saw in the early to mid 20th century.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's, I guess it's been called the information age or the computer age or whatnot. It's clearly moved beyond that into something new that's evolving. How it'll be looked upon 100, 200 years from now, I don't know. But I think you're absolutely right. It's we've moved on to some sort of new phase. Kenneth Clark's series ends, I think it was taped in the 1970s, so just before that big revolution. So you're right. Those things, those projects, and I think Nathan Lewis has written about it, they aren't the focal point of our civilization. They aren't what most interests people. Yes, you occasionally hear people talk about putting a man on Mars or whatever it might be, some equivalent 21st century feat to match what we saw in the 20th. But in general, I think you're right. The focus is shifting.
Could you make the case that Trump Tower is an example of heroic materialism?
Well, the skyscraper is. The skyscraper certainly is. I mean, even in the 1920s, when these buildings, when they were going up, people thought they were an example of just pure materialist folly. I mean, the Empire State Building, I don't think, was fully rented out for years, if not decades, after it was built, partly due to the Depression, partly because it was just so huge. So even at that time, people were beginning to think, geez, isn't this a bit much? And I think part of the reaction against that, part of what you saw beginning in the 60s and 70s with environmentalism, sort of back to the land movement, and I saw you you spoke with Jim Kunstler on your program.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I know he's somebody who was just criticized, along with several other people, you know, skyscrapers as being an unsustainable form of development, a relic of an earlier age, a relic of this heroic materialist age. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But
so you're talking about his cultural stance or engineering stance, or both?
I think some of what I've heard him talk about in some of his recent some of his recent works about, you know, a future prospects of a technological civilization. It gets all a little bit speculative for me, but I think in the sense of the cultural era we're in, yes, the idea of a skyscraper is no longer has quite the same interest for people as it did. You know, when it captured the imagination of New Yorkers and San Franciscans and various other, you know, Chicagoans 100 years ago.
Eiffel Tower was probably the first, like the early wave of that.
Yeah, the first, you know, the first time, first efforts to move away from masonry building and use iron or steel construction, which, you know, which was the major revolution. The other part of that, obviously, was the invention of the elevator. Because historically, you know, even going back thousands of years, people could have built a lot taller than they did. But the problem is nobody wants to walk up much more than five flights of stairs, no matter how little they're paying. I think it's a general principle. I mean, you see that even reflected in the New York tenements from the early and mid-1800s. I think it tops out at about five stories. People just don't want to walk up more than those flights of stairs. So once you have the elevator, that economic block to development is sidestepped, and after that, the sky's the limit.
And the other type of urbanism you comment on is green urbanism, and you talk about Frank Lloyd Wright's proposed Broadacre City and the Garden City movement. I mean, there's different versions of it. There's forms of, but his specific plan was to give everyone an acre each, and I don't think that would have been ecologically sustainable. But obviously, there's other models of green urbanism that are.
Yeah, well, I think when the word green is taken too literally in a lot of these contexts, I think in the general sense of ecologically responsible development, and, you know, which goes a lot beyond issues of land consumption. There's a role for it to play, but, you know, obviously my own perspective on this is that, and this is something that environmentalists, I think, have come around to over the last 10, 20, 25 years, is that, you know, often the best way to protect unspoiled lands is to have denser development. And obviously, the idea of 1 acre or 2 acre lots is completely inconsistent with that. You accelerate development over the land, and you still don't end up with a landscape that's really rural. So I think opinions have been changing on that.
You wrote an article about New York City's suburban demographic, and you pointed out that the population of young adults and children is rapidly declining in the wealthiest suburbs of New York, and that's the case all over the country. What do you see as the main causes? Is it schools or shortage of housing?
It's an interesting question. I think there's a couple schools of thought on this. I mean, one that's been a topic of several books. I'm thinking of End of the Suburbs by Leigh Gallagher, Alan Ehrenholz, The Great Inversion, Dead End is a recent book by Ben Ross, even Ed Glaser, Triumph of the City. People saying that, well, it's the magnetic pull of urban centers, the renewed appeal of urban living. It's drawing young people back to downtown urban areas where they can have walkable or more or less walkable lifestyle, don't have to rely on a car, have access to public transportation, all these various things. And I think that that's clearly true to an extent. What you're seeing in some of these suburbs, however, is I don't think there's been any loss, necessarily loss, an appeal to young families and living in these places. It's so really,
you're talking about the wealthiest suburbs, not suburbs in general?
Not even the wealthiest suburbs. Even I would say this applies broadly to many suburban areas of cities, especially where they have their own local political control, as what you've seen the last 20 or 30 years is just this increase in housing prices that has, you know, in combination with other economic factors, makes it very difficult for you know, somebody in their mid, late 20s, early 30s to realistically you know, purchase a place to live. Whether there are many factors that go into that. Zoning's just one part of it. There are financial issues as well that are weighing upon young people, whether that's student loans or other obligations that make it difficult for them to qualify to purchase. There's a whole lot of things that go into it, but I think the issue is for the suburbs is fundamentally a financial one rather than somehow that the suburbs have just have lost their appeal to young people, especially young families.
So do you think the suburbs are dead? I mean, what I mean is, like, do you think the suburbs would make a comeback anytime soon? Or, like, maybe if, like, let's say millennials get older and they want a slower pace of life, they would consider moving to the suburbs? What do you think?
That is, that's a great question. And I don't know that my own take on this is necessarily going to be more accurate or better than anybody else's. It's something that just gets written about all the time in newspapers, articles, books, whatnot. Everybody wants to be able to foresee the demographic future. But the short answer is no, I don't think the suburbs are dead economically. I think that the demographic issues that I was pointing out there were that a lot of these places, which have made low-cost housing very difficult to build and have made new housing supply very difficult to build, have seen artificially rising prices. And as a result, the demographics in these towns tend to age. Census by census, the average age creeps up. The number of children declines. And in that sense, It does appear like the town is stagnating, doesn't have appeal to younger people. What the breakthrough point is there, I don't know. If there's a breaking point where the politics are going to change and they're going to accommodate new development, I don't know. I mean, just speaking from my own experience in Connecticut with some of these towns that I wrote about, just because they're the ones I know, there is an awareness among the governments in these towns, the town governments, the zoning boards, that they don't have a lot of housing options for young people. Don't have a lot of rental housing options. They're not building small houses anymore. You know, the 1950s, 40s style, Cape style houses or ranches on a quarter acre that, my parents or grandparents might have bought back in the day. The will to actually build these sorts of places it's not really there yet. A time may come, but the question is whether it's going to come fast enough.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure from NIMBYs who want to prevent a newer development, but there's this sort of concept of incremental development. Maybe we don't need to take a suburb and turn it into maybe 10-story structures, but we could allow for more duplexes, allow for single-family homes to be turned into duplexes.
I know this is something I didn't listen to I don't think I got the entire thing. I listened to a lot of it, your conversation with Chuck Marone, who really comes at these issues from a financial perspective. you know, rather than discussing it in terms of suburban development or not suburban development, it's about how you're using your infrastructure and how you're taking advantage of your existing infrastructure. In a lot of cases, you have a sort of a legacy system of sewers and water lines, which can support very high density of development. And the zoning doesn't necessarily agree with that. And towns are trying to find a way to raise revenue. And a lot of what can be done can be just to take better advantage of what you already have. And if you need to expand, do so in a way that, you know, sort of, like you said, incrementally builds off that infrastructure in a financially responsible way. It doesn't necessarily mean no new developments, no new greenfield developments. It just means a clearer thought process as to how you're going to accommodate that growth and how it's going to relate back to the rest of the city.
I think we did touch on this earlier, but are you generally in favor of a green belts?
That's a tough question to answer. I guess what I could say is I'm generally in favor of an urban services boundary where, as in Lexington would be one example where the city services are expanded according to a general plan which avoids sort of excessive leapfrog development, and basically uses the land wisely. To draw a single line around a city where it can never be adjusted, I don't think that's entirely realistic. But as far as setting general guidelines for expansion, that's something I think that's been used with some success. I mean, obviously, Toronto is a case of a city with a similar boundary, Lexington, Portland, Oregon, and these have been adjusted over time, and they've been used as sort of generalized planning tools rather than ironclad boundaries. And I think used in that way, they're helpful.
And do you generally support historic preservation laws?
Well, what sort of laws are you talking about? I mean, there are all sorts of historic preservation laws out there, but from individual buildings to entire neighborhoods. But it's just like an example you had in mind.
Just in general, preventing historic structures from being torn down.
That is another real tough question, and that's another. I know it's sort of a market urbanism pet peeve, right?
Oh, because there's the landmark issue where one building gets designated, and there's whole historic preservation districts.
Right. There's so much that goes into that. And look, I'll acknowledge that there's certain parts of cities which are so historically significant or have a certain character that you'd really hate to see it dramatically transformed aesthetically. For example, a historic district which doesn't necessarily require that every single building be preserved with no changes, but rather that provides architectural guidelines for how new development should respect the existing architecture, even if it's not very stringent, just has general guidelines for that sort of thing. I do that sort of Parisian historic preservation. I'm more sympathetic to ones where an entire district of a city is supposed to be essentially locked in amber. I'm a little less supportive of. I think there has to be some room for change, and I think you have to have the confidence that you can do it in a way that respects the historic architecture rather than just living in fear of any change and assuming that whatever comes in is going to be terrible and a detriment to the neighborhood.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Charles Gardner for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Hey, thank you very much, Robert. Thank you a lot for having me on. Really appreciate it. Hope I got some interesting things on the record here, but it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, and also thanks to Sam Kevorkian.
You're welcome. It was a great show.